Nyanavahini, Chapter 1. As fog before the sun, ignorance melts away before knowledge. So say the scriptures. Knowledge is acquired by uninterrupted inquiry. One should constantly be engaged in the inquiry of the nature of Brahman, the reality of the I or the self, the transformations that occur to the individual at birth and at death, and such matters. As you remove the husk that covers up the rice, so too the ignorance that adheres to the mind has to be removed by the frequent application of the abrasive, that is, atmic inquiry. It is only when full knowledge is won that one can get liberated, or in other words, attain moksha or liberation. After the attainment of the above said atmic knowledge, one has to follow the path of Brahman, the absolute consciousness or God, and act according to the new wisdom. All doubts that afflict the mind have to be solved by consulting those who know, or the Sadgurus, the philosophers and guides that one has the chance to meet. Until one gets firmly fixed in the path that guru or teacher and shastras or category or scripture have shown, one has to obey the rules and directions steadfastly and be in their company or be associated with them one way or the other. Because one can progress very fast if one keeps close to the wise person who has realized the truth, one must with unrestricted renunciation and sincere earnestness follow the instructions of the teacher and of the shastras. This is the real tapas or asceticism. This tapas leads on to the highest stage. When ignorance and its concomitant delusion disappear, the atma, the soul or the inner motive force in everyone shines in its own splendor. All that we see is as a mirage, the superimposition of something over the real and the mistaking of that for this. Things have a beginning and they end. They evolve and involve. There is evolution as well as involution. When all is subsumed by involution or pralaya, only mula prakriti or the causal substance endures. Only the unmanifested cause survives the universal dissolution. When gold is melted in the crucible, it shines with a strange yellow glory. Where did that light emanate from? From the gold or from the fire? What happened was only the removal of the dross by the fire. The effulgence belonged to the gold itself. It is its very nature. The fire is only an instrument for the removal of the dross. Nothing has been added to the gold by the fire in the crucible. If fire can give the splendor, then why does not a stick or blade or pebble placed in the fire become as shining as gold? So one has to conclude that the splendor came not through fire, but out of its own inner nature. The Pratyag Atma, or the inner presiding Atma, is separate from the five sheaths of the individual, the Panchakoshas. It shines with its own splendor. It is the witness of the activities and consequences of the three gunas or qualities. It is immovable. It is holy and pure. It is eternal, it is indivisible, it is self-manifested, it is peace. It has no end, it is wisdom itself. Such an Atma has got to be cognized as oneself. To realize this Atma, this Jnana Swarupa, or embodiment of wisdom, There are four obstacles to be overcome. Laya or sleep, vikshepa, waywardness or ignorance hiding the truth, kshaya, decline or disappearance, and rasa asvadhanam, enjoyment of bliss. Let us take these one by one. Laya or sleep. When the mind withdraws from the external world, it enters into deep sleep or sushupti on account of the overpowering influence of samsara, change or flux. The sadhaka, the aspirant for spiritual progress, should arrest this tendency and attempt to fix the mind onto atma vichara, or the inquiry into the nature of the atma. He must keep watch over the mind, so that he may keep awake. He must discover the circumstances that induce the drowsiness and remove them in time. He must start the process of dhyana or meditation again and again. Of course, the usual producer of drowsiness and sleep during dhyana is indigestion. Overfeeding, exhaustion through too much of moving about, want of sufficient sleep at night, these two cause sleepiness and drowsiness. So it is advisable to sleep a little during noon, on those days when you wake up after a sleepless night, though generally, all those who engage in dhyanam should avoid sleep during daytime. Do not eat until you feel proper hunger. Practice the art of moderate eating. When you feel three-fourths full, desist from further eating. That is to say, you will have to stop even when you feel you can eat a little more. The stomach can be educated in this way to behave properly. Over-exercise too is not good. Even walking can be overdone. You can walk until you conquer drowsiness, but remember, you cannot plunge into dhyanam or meditation immediately after you have warded off sleep. Vikshepa, or waywardness. The mind seeks to run after external objects, and so constant effort is needed to turn it inwards, away from the attractions of sensory impressions. This has to be done through the rigorous exercise of the intellect of inquiry. Discriminate and get the conviction driven into you that these are evanescent, temporary, transformable, liable to decay, and therefore unreal, not truth. That is mithya, not satya. Convince yourselves that what is sought after as pleasurable and avoided as painful are only the fleeting products of sensory contacts. Train yourself in this way to avoid the distractions of the external world and dive deep into dhyanam or meditation. A sparrow pursued by a hawk flies in despair for shelter into a house. But it is anxious to fly again into the outer world, isn't it? So also, the mind is anxious to go again into the outer world, from the Atma where it takes refuge. Vikshepa is this mental attitude, the urge to run back into the world from one's shelter. The removal of Vikshepa alone will help the concentration of the mind in dhyanam or meditation. Kshaya, or decline. The mind is drawn with immense force by all the unconscious and subconscious impulses and instincts of passion and attachment towards the external world and its multitudinous attractions. It therefore experiences untold misery and might even get lost in its depths. This is the stage called kshaya, or decline. The state of inertia into which one is driven by despair cannot be called samadhi. or one might even indulge in daydreaming in order to escape from present misery. Or one might start building castles in the air. All this is due to attachment to the temptations of the outer world. There is another type of attachment too, the attachment to the inner world. The planning within oneself of various schemes to better oneself in the future as compared to the past. Both these form part of what is called kshaya. The basis for both is the attraction of the outer world. Attachment brings about desire. Desire leads to planning. Rasa asvadana. When kshaya and vikshepa are overcome, one attains the savikalpananda, the bliss of the highest subject-object contact. This stage is what is called rasasvadhanam, or the enjoyment of bliss. Even this is not the highest of the supreme bliss, which one does not attain or acquire, but simply is, becomes aware of, so to say. The rasa, or the sweetness of the subject-object samadhi, is a temptation that one has to avoid, for it is only the second best. It is enough joy to act as a handicap. The joy is as great as that of a person who has just deposited a huge load he has been carrying for long. Or is that of a greedy person who has just killed a serpent guarding a vast treasure that he wanted to grab. The killing of the serpent is savikalpa samadhi. The acquisition of the treasure, that is the nirvikalpa samadhi, the highest stage. When the sun rises, darkness as well as the troubles arising from it disappear. Similarly, for those who have realized the Atma, there is no bondage anymore, nor the sorrow arising from that bondage. Delusion comes only to those who forget their bearings. Egoism is the greatest factor in making people forget their very basic truth. Once egoism enters into man, he slips from the ideal and precipitates himself from the top of the stairs in quick falls from step to step down to the very bottom floor. Egoism breeds schisms, hatreds and attachments. Through attachments and affection, and even envy and hatred, one plunges into activity and gets immersed in the world. This leads to embodiment in the physical frame and further egoism. In order to become free from the twin pulls of pleasure and pain, one must rid oneself of the body consciousness and keep clear of self-centered actions. This again involves the absence of attachment and hatred. Desire is the number one enemy of liberation or moksha. Desire binds one to the wheel of birth and death. It brings about endless worry and tribulations. Through inquiry on these lines, knowledge is rendered clearer and brighter, and liberation is achieved. Moksha is only another word for independence, not depending on any outside thing or person. If well controlled and trained, the mind can lead one on to moksha. It must be saturated in the thought of God. That will help the inquiry into the nature of reality. The consciousness of the ego itself will fade away when the mind is free from pulls and when it is rendered pure. Not to be affected in any way by the world, that is the path to self-realization. It cannot be got in svarga, that is heaven, or in Mount Kailash, the abode of Shiva. The flame of desire cannot be put out without the conquest of the mind. The mind cannot be overcome without the scorching of the flames of desire. The mind is the seed, desire is the tree. Atma-jnana, awareness of the Atma alone, can uproot that tree. So these three are interdependent. Mind, desire, and Atma-jnana. The Jivan-mukta, he who is liberated even when alive, is established firmly in the knowledge of the Atma. He has achieved it by dwelling on the mithya, the unreality of the world, and contemplating its failings and faults. By this means he has developed an insight into the nature of pleasure and pain, and an equanimity in both. He knows that wealth, worldly joy and pleasure are all worthless and even poisonous. He takes praise, blame, and even blows with a calm assurance, unaffected by both honor and dishonor. Of course, the Jivan Mukta reached that stage only after long years of systematic discipline and unflagging zeal when distress and doubt assailed him. Defeat only made him more rigorous in self-examination and more earnest about following the prescribed discipline. The Jivan Mukta has no trace of the so-called will to live. He is ever ready to drop into the lap of death.